Good afternoon, members of the division. I'm Sheila Meir, registration number 1508, representing the appellant, Lorne Priam, who is here in the courtroom with me today. As you know, we have pursued three issues on appeal, the first being a fatal Dekoven violation by the board, the second being the board's erroneous interpretation of Section 24.5.101, the Employment and Licensure Rehabilitation Statute, and third, the board's erroneous application of Administrative Procedure Act Section 24-4-10515B concerning the board's authority to affect or change conclusions of fact and law. I hope you will agree that the parties have fully briefed the issues before you today. Nevertheless, Mr. Priam asked for this oral argument specifically because we hope to avoid the case being derailed by a simplistic and, under the circumstances, unfair remedy, and that is a remand to the board to redo its final agency deliberation under the Dekoven principles. We do not believe justice will be served if this matter is sent back to the board for another vote for many important reasons, those reasons which should tip the balance toward obtaining a substantive, meaningful opinion here. There are five reasons, at least, to review them first. Mr. Priam won at the hearing level, so unlike in Dekoven, he will not be, no windfall will result. Second, this board is fatally compromised and biased, having already denied the license twice, first at the time of initial application, and second on appellate review.
Same six members on the board both times?
Yes, I believe so.
How is that different from what the facts were in Dekoven?
In Dekoven, the school board did not have any initial action taken. It did not take any initial action. It was not the entity that first reviewed and denied the application. It only had essentially a single bite. It went back to the same board on the remand, but it was not the agency that had twice before, as this agency, ruled against the appellant, in this case the applicant for licensure. The third reason not to send this back is that the rule of necessity is not operational here, since there is a valid initial agency decision to substitute as the final agency decision. This court has already done that, and done it fairly recently in a case called Mosgenba, and I hope I pronounced that correctly. We have briefed that decision in both of our briefs. Fourth, the board's misconduct in this matter was so flagrant, and the board has been so remorseless on appeal that it has forfeited the opportunity to act again. The answer brief minimizes, in all respects, the conduct of the agency and its chief witness at the time of its deliberations. Finally, because the record is so overwhelmingly supportive of rehabilitation and therefore reinstatement, there is no point in extending this litigation any longer. Let me address this last point, the substance of the dispute, that is the question of rehabilitation. This is not a case in which disputed evidence of rehabilitation is at issue. This is a case in which all the evidence provides and proves rehabilitation. Contrary to the board's insistence otherwise, it was required to counter and overcome post-conviction evidence. Colorado Real Estate Commission versus Bartlett, decided in this court in June of this year, clears up the question whether the agency bears the burden and must use post-conviction evidence to defeat rehabilitation. It must. It did not.
Ask a question about that. My understanding from Bartlett, and I may be confusing it with the other case, and I don't know how you pronounce it, starts with a Z, but I think both cases were in the context of a revocation. So in that context, the board may very well have the burden of burden to come forward with some evidence on rehabilitation, but do they in this context that we have here? This is not a revocation proceeding.
Here's the reason the answer is yes, Judge Logan. First, 24.5.101 applied to Bartlett only because the Real Estate Commission organic statute bootstrapped itself back into that statute. The statute, by its terms and on its face, uses the word applicant. So this applies to applicants. And Mr. Priam, in this case, is an applicant. So the statute at hand specifically applies to him. And through Bartlett, only because of the Real Estate Commission dragging that statute back into the Real Estate Commission, were we able to apply it to a revocation. So the answer would be that if it applies in a revocation, which is applicable only because of an adoption or incorporation, surely it's applicable on its face when the statute itself says rehabilitation of applicants.
Well, let me cut to the chase then and see, make sure I understand your ultimate contention. Is it your contention, forget about the burden of proof issue, is it your contention that where there has been rehabilitation, and the rehabilitation itself hasn't been rebutted, that the board then is mandated to grant the license? It has no discretion to do otherwise?
That's correct.
Okay.
Ms. Veer, let me ask you a question. This is going to take a minute or two to set up, so please wait until I've completed the question. There is a scenario in which the division could conclude that it was a problem or a deprivation of due process rights to have the inspector in the room during the board's deliberation. However, there's also a scenario in which, even if that were the case, the division could conclude that the only appropriate remedy is a remand to the board, understanding that you're arguing vociferously against that. But there is a scenario in which that could happen. If that were the case, you have also argued that you don't want your client to have to incur the expense of doing a remand and then coming back again to the Court of Appeals. So my question is this. If the division were to view both of those issues the way I've just stated and to conclude that only a remand to the board were appropriate, would you waive such a remand in order to get the merits of the appeal decided now?
Yes. And I was quick to that. I hope it wasn't vociferous to that, but I was quick to that, Judge Terry, simply because we've had a clear indication of the thinking of this board for now, what are we going on, 3 years. It is inexorably opposed to the relicensure of this human being, and there's no point in believing that that would change under any set of circumstances.
Understood. Thank you.
There is no disputed evidence, in my opinion, not even announced. All of it, the entire record of it, establishes rehabilitation. The board ran, in our opinion, a freight train over the facts, over the conclusions of fact, over the law, over the conclusions of law, and it to reach its decision, and should not be rewarded for its strategy and its intransigence. Section 245101 really is a remarkable statute. This is an era in which state legislatures are denying ex-felons the right to vote and other civil rights, and yet this legislature continues to lean quite in the other direction. This legislature has required state professional and occupational licensing agencies to provide a second chance to those licensees convicted of felonies who demonstrate true repentance and rehabilitation, regardless of a few stated exceptions, none of which applies here, to the nature of those felonies. None of those exceptions apply. But with this inexplicable ferocity and determination, some of those agencies have refused to submit to the legislature's vision and its progressiveness, including this board. Here I submit to you that we present a man who could not, if he had tried, done more to resurrect an honorable life. The unchallenged record reveals a thoroughly chastised, repentant, and renovated human being. One thing is the person the legislature must have had in mind when it passed this statute. If the facts in this case do not invoke the protection of 245101, no case ever will.
It's mandatory for the board to reinstate him because they find rehabilitation based on the last sentence of section 245101. That's what you're telling us, right?
I think that it is a shall statute. A shall statute, making it a mandatory statute.
It says that the facts of this conviction shall be given consideration. Which they did here, right? They did give consideration.
Correct.
Of course, you don't like the way they considered it, but they considered it. And the last sentence says, the intent of the section is to expand employment opportunities for people who have been rehabilitated. I don't see where you see a mandatory word in that last sentence where they're actually talking about rehabilitation.
If you can't, if the board cannot overcome the proof of rehabilitation, that's what I believe makes it mandatory. The statute sets up what will be considered. What happened here? There was a felony conviction. What about that felony conviction? Let's talk about that felony conviction. And now, since that is the basis for the misconduct and the original licensure, either discipline or denial of license, the next question is what the statute's all about. Okay, has this person been rehabilitated? Because if this person's been rehabilitated, it trumps that earlier felony conviction, which otherwise would be absolutely disqualifying future professional licensure.
Case that says that. That's your interpretation of it, right?
I think reading Zamarripa and Bartlett and the statute together, I believe that it is supportive. If the facts in this case do not invoke the protection of the statute, judges, I don't believe a case ever will. It is to us that clear-cut and undeniable. If the right to reinstatement under the statute is not established here, this statute is absolutely meaningless, and the hope of a new productive life for rehabilitated felons is a cruel charade. We are before you today simply to reiterate our belief that Mr. Prem has prevailed in this case on both procedural and substantive grounds, and is entitled, looking at the totality of the case, to a definitive and dispositive decision from the court which will allow him a second chance to distinguish himself in this ancient and honorable profession. Unless there are more questions, I will reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Let's have one. Under the pharmacy board statute, there was appears to be more than one grounds for why they did not reinstate his license. Not just the fact that there was a felony conviction, but I guess also that he had violated a federal law pertaining to drugs, and also that they found him unfit. Those aren't necessarily criminal related conduct, and yet the statute says they only have to consider 24-5-101 if they're considering the conviction of a crime.
Those original grounds are irrelevant because the notice of denial here, the notice of charges, meaning the notice of denial here, sets forth three counts: felony, misdemeanor. The fourth count was dismissed.
So your position is that none of these are considered by the board?
Correct.
Thank you, Ms. Mayor. You've got about 3 minutes and 20 seconds for any rebuttal that you would like.
Thank you both. Thank you all.
Excuse me, Your Honor. Honors, may it please the court. Joanna Lee Kay, registration number 20486, on behalf of the Colorado State Board of Pharmacy. Now, Your Honors, I want to clarify before I launch into my presentation one thing. The board did not overturn the ALJ's finding of rehabilitation. The board specifically adopted the finding of rehabilitation, but then weighted against other factors and ultimately decided to deny the license. So I think that that's not been perfectly clear. I want to make sure that that's perfectly clear. So that means that the main issue before this panel today is this: does the showing of rehabilitation eliminate the board's discretion and require licensure under 24-5-101? Or can the board still exercise its discretion if there is a reasonable basis in the law for its interpretation of the statute?
Let me interrupt you right there and kind of do the opposite of what we were challenging Ms. Mayor on. I mean, I understand your basic argument is the board has the discretion to look at things like practice-specific violations and say those outweigh any rehabilitation. But, I mean, here you have a case where the rehabilitation was clear. I mean, wouldn't the what kind of case would there ever be in the future where a board wouldn't say, well, the Court of Appeals has issued this opinion and it's not going to be abuse of our discretion. The action was practice specific, so we're done. I mean, how are they ever going to exercise their discretion to come out the other way?
Well, I think that that's a matter of board's discretion, Your Honor, and in this case, the statute basically says that the felony conviction cannot be the sole basis for the denial. So that if you have an applicant who previously had and abused a license in the same profession, that is an additional factor to be considered. The felony is not the sole basis. It is the pertinent underlying circumstances which are. So that if Mr.
Isn't that form over substance? It is the felony. It's exactly the conduct that he was convicted of.
Well, Your Honor, I beg to differ, and let me explain why. Mr. Coon wants the panel to substitute its judgment here for that of the board. And what is the reasonable basis, in other words, is what you're asking. The reasonable basis here for the denial is that the statute was intended to level the playing field, so that if Mr. Prem were applying for licensure in some other area, where he had not violated, used his license to steal and sell drugs and violate that particular statute for that other licensing agency, then you might, there might be an argument. There probably would be an argument that the existing felony conviction would be the sole basis. But that's not the case here. Here, the case is, even if there had never been a felony conviction, just the underlying violations and the resulting revocation alone would have been reasonable grounds for the denial, the board's denial of this licensure. So even assuming the existence of no felony whatsoever, the board would still have been on solid grounds to deny the license.
Any basis where Mr. Prem could ever come back in the future and change this board's mind because he's got this prior conduct which is practice related. How could it ever change in the future? And doesn't that essentially make it mandatory rather than discretionary what the board did here?
I would argue, Your Honor, no, it would not make this a mandatory situation. The length of time, the particular circumstances, basically you're asking me to speculate about what the board might do in another 3 years. But that would be a different case for the board's discretion. One of the pertinent circumstances that the board is entitled to consider is the length of time it has been. So I would submit that this decision at this time in this case does not mean a permanent denial. It means a denial at this time under these circumstances. In other words, the length of time that has passed is one of the circumstances that the board is entitled and indeed required to consider.
You mentioned another 3 years. Is there something barring Mr. Prem for a particular period from coming back, or can he come back anytime?
He can come back anytime, Your Honor. Okay.
As long as I've got you answering a question here, I'd like to have you address Ms. Muir's point about the notice of the hearing having only three counts and that the board couldn't consider any of the other statutory factors except for the felony and the misdemeanor.
That's a clever and interesting development, Your Honor. What is left is 245.101, both provides for and requires the board to consider the pertinent underlying circumstances. So the dismissal of count four wasn't really relevant. It wasn't, it's not really dispositive in the least, because the pertinent underlying circumstances remain what they are. So
could the board consider the other statutory factors that Judge Richman was mentioning, such as fitness and the other factors for licensure?
Well, absolutely, Your Honor. Unless Your Honors disagree that those are pertinent underlying circumstances, which the board is required to consider, then absolutely the board is entitled and required to consider those as pertinent circumstances underlying the felony convictions, because those same circumstances were the same circumstances that led to the felony convictions. Okay, so once again, those are the pertinent circumstances in this case. Now, if you follow Mr. Prem's interpretation of the statute, it means that a showing of rehabilitation requires licensure no matter what those pertinent circumstances were, despite the Prior Practice Act violations and despite his resulting prior revocation of a license in the same field where he's applying for licensure now. Now, that alone, as I said, would have constituted grounds for denial under the board's statutes. So the practical effect of this interpretation is, if you violate your license and you lose it, and you also happen to be accused of a felony, you better make sure and get convicted, because it gives you a greater right to get your license back than you would have if you didn't get convicted of the felony.
So you shouldn't be pleading guilty to an obstructed windshield. You should make sure you get the felony conviction.
Better make sure and get a conviction. Yeah. So there's the reasonable basis. Is the board's interpretation of the statute more reasonable? I submit to you today that the board's interpretation is the more reasonable interpretation. The statute was intended to give convicted, rehabilitated felons an equal right to a chance at licensure before a state agency. Not a greater right, an equal chance, okay? For instance, if he applied to be a motor vehicle dealer board salesman or something, if there's some specific violation of the statute governing that area of practice, then he would be back to the statute 245.101 would protect him for licensure because you would be left with the felony being the sole basis for the denial in that case. That's clearly not what happened here. Okay, the sole basis for the denial was not the felony. The
problem is, of course, the statute doesn't say that expressly. I mean, these are all matters of interpretation. It doesn't say, you know, if it's a practice-specific violation, then that basically wipes out the statute that says you get a better break just if you've been a convicted felon. And so you're giving us an interpretation, but the statute doesn't have that specific kind of exception in it.
Actually, I would argue that it does, Your Honor. I think that that's might have been part of what the legislature had in mind when it said the board must consider the pertinent underlying circumstances. So I believe that, you know, if that's a reasonable interpretation, then respectfully speaking, Your Honors, should defer to the board's decision, because if there is a reasonable basis in the law, as the case law has firmly established, if there's a reasonable basis for the board's interpretation of the statute, it must be upheld because it's not arbitrary and capricious just by very definition. So I'm going to talk about this issue of rehabilitation requiring licensure again. The legislature chose two expressions: rehabilitation and the pertinent circumstances underlying the felony convictions. Now, the canons of construction require that those two expressions mean something different, or else one of them is going to be rendered meaningless. So I'm going to submit to you that rehabilitation is a necessary requirement to bring Mr. Crean within the protections of 245-101, but it is not alone sufficient, because if that's the only thing that Mr. Crean had to show, then the pertinent underlying circumstances language in the statute is rendered meaningless. The court in Zamaripa even directly talked about application of the language to convicted rehabilitated felons and said the board is entitled in its discretion when considering a convicted rehabilitated felon. So in other words, the Supreme Court, in its language, specifically contemplated that the felon was rehabilitated, but in the same sentence said the board can exercise its discretion when considering the application of a convicted rehabilitated felon. So let's see.
I have a basic question for you. We keep referencing 245-101, and that is provides that whenever an agency is required to make a finding that an applicant for a license is a person of good moral character as a condition to the issuance thereof. I haven't seen anything that tells me if that is the case for this particular licensing situation.
Very good question, Your Honor. Our statute does not say anything specific about a requirement of a finding of good moral character, but because of the nature of this particular practice, I think that it's kind of presumed that the board is going to exercise its discretion in considering whether or not an individual is of good moral character or not.
So is it your position then that subsection 2 applies even though it's not a specific requirement that they find a good person of good moral character? There's nothing in your organic statutes that requires it, but nevertheless you're conceding that it applies.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
This is what I was getting at before. Clearly, 245-101 applies because under your Enabling Act or whatever it's called, if you go to the conditions of discipline, it says if you're considering a crime, you've got to go look at 245-101.
Absolutely.
And what I was trying to ask Ms. Samir was the board considering the conduct other than conviction of a crime, namely whether a state or federal law pertaining to drugs was violated? And I don't mean criminal law, it could be a civil law, right?
Yeah.
Or he's unfit or incompetent by reason of habits or for any other cause to practice, which could, I suppose, be bad moral character. Now, she said that wasn't part of the case because it wasn't specified in the charges. So what I'm getting at then is, what were the grounds for discipline that referred us back over to the disciplinary statute? Was that specified in the very first decision where it denied his license?
Yeah, absolutely, Judge Richmond.
I mean, denied reinstatement.
So it's important to remember that the revocation of Mr. Crean's license occurred before there were ever any felony convictions to begin with. And so there's clearly the grounds for revocation existed in the complete absence of any felony convictions. Did not.
Okay, and then when he applied for reinstatement before he went for the ALJ proceeding, they denied it there. Was there a written order, a written document that says that we're denying it because of these particular grounds for discipline that you violated?
We just
got a letter saying denied.
There was a letter saying that we've considered your application and we've denied it on the basis of past discipline against your pharmacist license. That was actually the original notice, was that was the reason that they cited, was that the past discipline against your pharmacist license.
I would argue that that is included more than just criminal convictions. And may
well, yes, because the revocation occurred before the convictions did. So now I want to just talk about Bartlett for one quick minute, because that's all I have. Bartlett's, once again, I think it was mentioned during Ms. Muir's presentation that Bartlett applied to a licensee who was the proponent of the order. And the language in that case is very clear that this licensee, as the proponent of the order, bore the burden of proof because he had an existing property right. Same for Zamarripa. In both of those cases, they applied to individuals with existing property rights. And the assignment of burden of proof in the Bartlett case did not, in fact, in any way, the fact that the burden of proof remains on this individual as the proponent of the order seeking to change the status quo by obtaining a license. That Renteria case, the case was very clear that when you are seeking a license, you bear the burden of proof to show fitness for licensure. So let me see if I've got everything that I wanted to cover. Oh, and also in Bartlett, rehabilitation was an issue in dispute. So the reason that the Bartlett court spoke so heavily about that, yes, the board bore the burden of showing of overcoming the showing of rehabilitation, is because it was an issue in dispute. In this case, it's been conceded. The board said, yes, you've got very good evidence showing rehabilitation, which is a necessary showing, but if it is not insufficient, if the board's interpretation in this case was reasonable application and interpretation of the law, and clearly there's substantial evidence in the record, it was forthrightly conceded by Mr. Preen. Under oath. So if those two grounds, or if those two conditions exist, then this board should respectfully uphold the board's decision to deny licensure in this case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Kay. You got 3 minutes and 19 seconds.
This argument this is a back and fill argument. I respectfully say that it's quite disingenuous. We have a case called Michelli versus the Board of Pharmacy that this court decided many years ago. I'm afraid I didn't bring it along with me. But that case clearly established that you try the case on the charges, unless during the course of the administrative hearing evidence comes into that enlarges those charges without objection. So we tried this case. There was a letter, I think it's Exhibit M, Judge Richmond. There was a letter that said when he applied for a new license, because it wasn't a reinstatement, it was a new license, because he has to go through the internship again. It said, yeah, it's denied based on the past, on everything that's gone before. But when it came down to the actual notice of denial and notice of charges, which is what this case was framed by, noticed upon for due process considerations and tried to
sign. Was that issued?
It was. Two counts.
No, I understand. When was that issued? After Exhibit M was sent?
Oh, much later.
Okay.
After, when Exhibit M was issued, he then appealed. And after he appealed, they had to issue a notice of charges, called a notice of denial in this situation. And that notice of denial states only the grounds of felony, misdemeanor, and the fourth count was dismissed on our own motion as irrelevant. So to say to you now that the board had anything in its discretionary mind is disingenuous. The board raised the issues of felony and misdemeanor conviction. And they should stand or they should sink on that issue. And they can.
Let me ask you, 24-5-101-2, is it your contention that it applies in this case, even though there's nothing in the organic statutes that says it has to be a person of good moral character?
I believe so, yes.
Okay. And then why to get to your opponent's point, why can't then the board consider pertinent circumstances connected with the conviction?
Because the case is framed under the APA on the charges that are brought. And although,
but even though the APA applies, doesn't the statute still require the board to consider those things?
If the court will take a look at the initial agency decision, and as it's adopted by the FAO, none of this stuff is in there. The ALJ did not enter findings of fact and conclusions of law on any of these points. It's not an issue in this case. It was never made an issue in this case. The board did not try this case on its original reasons for surrender of license, which equals revocation. It did not. When it came back around again, they said the reason you can't have a license is that you've been convicted.
So is your contention the board could not consider anything having to do with fitness except for the convictions?
It could, Judge, could it? But that would have been post-conviction evidence. It would have been that's why they would have had to, if they had the opportunity to rebut the evidence of rehabilitation and didn't take it.
Where does it say it's limited to post-conviction evidence?
I believe that's what the reading of Zamarripa and Bartlett have to tell us, because if it's not limited to that, it's already a fait accompli. The conviction is done. So reconsider anything must mean you have to go beyond that. And I believe that's what Zamarripa and Bartlett both tell us.
Thank you, Ms. Mayor.
Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. Case will stand submitted. We'll issue an opinion in due course.